So we've been talking about the Four Noble Truths, these foundational teachings that the Buddha gave at the beginning of his teaching and for the decades of his teaching, coming back again and again to these truths. He first taught them in the turning of the wheel of the Dhamma teaching. And I like that a lot because that wheel image is going to help carry us through our understanding of this fourth noble truth in the big long list. We can think of it also as more of a wheel, like a basket that holds our practice and lets us find many, many different access points for how we want to practice or what feels like the right way for us to practice at different times. But to bring us up to point, we'll just do a quick recap of 1, 2, and 3. So the first noble truth is this teaching, this revolutionary, like speak truth to power teaching that there's going to be discomfort and stress and unease in this life. That's just the way it is. It's nothing personal. It's not because you did anything wrong. It's just the truth of it. Things aren't always going to go the way we wish they would. It's a quality called dukkha, sometimes translated as suffering, not like uneasiness or stress in general, but sometimes I like a little suffering. Sometimes I'm like, yeah, suffering. You feel it. Mm-hmm. It comes in all kinds of different flavors and levels of intensity, doesn't it? This unsatisfactory quality. So that's the first noble truth. The second noble truth is that there's a cause to this dissatisfactoriness. There's a reason for it, and it's because we get so caught up in craving. Some teachers offer that maybe there's a translation problem when we, or a hiccup with the translation going from the Pali, the language that these teachings were originally written in, to contemporary English. We say, oh, you know, there's dukkha, the cause of dukkha is craving, and some people would just say being caught in craving is dukkha. Mm-hmm. So that's the second noble truth, that there is a cause, there's a root. The third noble truth is simply that peace is possible. We can find freedom and liberation from being caught in the unease and pain of craving. And the fourth noble truth that we're going to investigate this evening is that it's the map that shows us how to free our hearts and minds from that snare of craving that causes so much stress and suffering. And that map leads us to being able to let go of the places that we're caught and the places that we're clinging and the places that we're holding on so tightly. And when we can do that, we become a little bit more free. For some of us, maybe we're just aiming to feel a little bit more free in this moment, you know, breath by breath. Some practitioners are going for ultimate freedom in this lifetime, which the Buddha taught was possible. The Buddha demonstrated was possible to move to a place of just unshakable peace in his being. So that freedom is possible, and this is the map that spells out how to get there. And I really appreciate this. It's like freedom of the heart and mind for dummies. Like, here's what to do. It's not like highfalutin esoteric concepts to wrestle with in the darkness of a philosophical night. It's like real pragmatic. Here's how we can live the Dharma to move toward freedom. It's called a path sometimes, you know, the Eightfold Path, which brings to mind this really embodied practice. It's moving, it's doing, it's walking this path, not just contemplating it, living it. The one quibble I might offer with the path image is that can sometimes feel real linear, or like we're on the path or off the path. And so that's maybe where that wheel can come back in to give us another way to understand it. We aren't getting the right grades on one of these path factors and then graduating up to the next one in a plop, 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 you know, progress toward a goal. It's just about the journey of it and kind of weaving in and out. For me, in my experience, it's weaving in and out of what feels alive with these different factors at different times. And it may be because I heard some teaching that just lit me up, and now I'm just wanting to practice wise speech, one of the path factors, and that's just so lively for me right now. Other times it may be because I just messed things up so dramatically by not practicing impeccably with one of the factors. And it's like, oh, ouch, that hurt, and I really need to pay some attention to this place where I've been a little sloppy and have not been impeccable with my practice. And then other times it may really be that kind of step by step by step, and I'm going to work my way through these, and I'm going to, whether it's today or this week or this month, you know, I want to investigate the first factor and dig in and read the suttas about it and write and reflect and talk to my friends about it. And then I'll go on to the next one and really developing that full understanding of what the Buddha taught and that reflection on how it can apply in my life. So I love this, this Fourth Noble Truth. It's relational. The Buddha taught that it's through practicing the Eightfold Path that we gain admirable friends, uplifting, wholesome, bright-spirited friends who can support us on our path in life. It's through following this map that we bring those people into our lives. And he taught that's the whole of the holy life in some ways, is to be surrounded by those kinds of people who are going to uplift us and who we might have the opportunity to uplift at all. So it's very relational. And I think one caveat I would have, or one like little flag that has been my experience, so I'll just flag it in case any of you can relate. It's not actually meant to be a self-help project. It's not like another thing to do to improve ourselves, per se. That's not how I understand it. And we see that in part because one of the path factors is wise mindfulness, just being present with what is and bringing that quality of awareness and clear view to what's actually going on in this moment. There's a time and a place to try to turn our hearts and minds towards something more wholesome, but this isn't meant to beat ourselves up for all the ways we're not being perfectly Eightfold Pathy. It's just a process. In the Samyutta Nikaya, the Buddha is recorded to have said, "To give oneself up to indulgence in sensual pleasure, or to give oneself up to self-mortification. Both these extremes I have avoided and have discovered the middle path, which leads to peace, to discernment, to nibbana, to freedom." So that's this middle path. You know, it's meant to be a place of gentle exploration for us, not a thing to whip ourselves with. One of the ways we might think about it is that it's that these eight path factors I've alluded to, these eight steps or these eight regions on the map that we might explore, some of them refer more to sort of internal activities that we might engage in, you know, the practice, for instance, of cultivating mindfulness. So there's this inner cultivation, and then some of the factors refer more to the outer expression of our practice. So wise speech was the one I mentioned before. So it really brings it together into this whole path, this whole practice. How am I relating inside? What's my inner cultivation? And then how am I expressing that and living that outside? So right before we do the first rundown on the list, I'll just be real transparent about how I like to use the Pali. The word that I've been already saying is wise, like wise speech. That word is sama in Pali. It's often translated as right, as in right speech. And I know, because I've studied up on this stuff, I know it doesn't mean right, like right and wrong. I know it's meant to point to this quality of wholesomeness and leaning toward purification, leaning forward. But my hackles still rise when I hear right, and that I need to, I still hear that if I'm not doing these things right, I'm doing them wrong. So I skip that, and I use wise. Welcome to find the understanding that is your clearest understanding of maybe what was being taught and what pertains for you. Right, whole, perfected, complete. Those are some options you could substitute for sama, for wise. So we're going to look at it in these three sort of arenas, these three terrains of sila, which is our ethical conduct in the world. It's how we're acting and what we're doing. And samadhi, our meditation practices and concentration practices, and the ways that we're cultivating those qualities. And then panya, which is how we're cultivating wisdom and clear view of what's really going on. So this Eightfold Path gets taught in, like I said, it gets taught in this list that you can rattle down, or the sort of bigger baskets. We're going to go with the big basket approach today. Starting with sila, or conduct, where we find wise speech, wise action, and wise livelihood. These are how we're showing up in the world, really relational, right? How we're engaging with people, how we're engaging with money, wise livelihood, right? And I'm just going to say, because it can get overwhelming and we don't have the time, you know, every single one of these could be a full retreat or a full Dharma talk, so I'm just going to say a little bit about each one. And as I said, I'll pull in a couple other voices as well before we have the chance to talk about it. Wise speech, or samavacha, is to abstain from lying and divisive speech and idle chatter. It's to speak at times that are timely, and when we're motivated by saying something that will be useful and beneficial and kind for the other person. And if I just said that we could spend a whole retreat talking about that, I take it back. I mean, I could spend my whole lifetime working on cultivating wiser speech and still have some work to go. Isn't that just one of the places we get ourselves into a pickle and lead ourselves to, lead myself to cringing? Like, oh, God, did I actually say that? Like, yeah. And it feels to me like, in my experience, the cringeworthy things that come out of my mouth, they've gotten more subtle over time. like I'm a little bit more skillful in general, but then the times that I just had to get that little barb in or whatever, you know, I feel them more. Maybe I suffer more over them now. I'm like, oof, not cool. Still have an area of practice around wise speech. Wise action, samakamanta. So the Buddha teaches this as being around, we think about it in the terms of the precepts, these training guidelines that we take on. Certainly in retreat contexts we'll do it, but many of us choose to take them on in terms of how we live our lives, of refraining from taking life, refraining from unwise speech and telling lies, refraining from sexual misconduct, refraining from, what else am I refraining from? Where are we at with our precepts?
What did you say?
Okay. We're not going to lie. We're not going to take life. We're not going to steal. We're not going to do sexual misconduct. Oh,
alcohol.
Right. And refraining from alcohol or intoxicants. Yeah. See, I knew this crowd could help me out. So, I had this one fun little thing that I found. I found the refraining from sexual misconduct framed as refraining from unchastity.
Okay.
Unchastity.
Refraining from.
Did I say that wrong?
Refraining.
Yeah, because we wouldn't.
From chastity.
No, we wouldn't refrain from chastity. Chastity is like we wouldn't.
Chastity is the thing that's not sexual. So you're refraining from chastity.
No, we want to be chaste.
Yes, I know, but. So we don't want to refrain from it.
I'm glad it didn't just do my mind for a dizzy. I was like, wow, I need to find out more about that word.
And it would be practicing unchastity if you want to say the unchastity, wouldn't it? Because otherwise it's a double negative, I think.
It is a double
and
negative.
And take the way of trying to refrain from a brahmacharya, which is the opposite of brahmacharya, which is chastity.
Mm.
That's what the precept says.
Yes.
I heard an interpretation, I think it might have been in a yoga context or maybe through Jainism, but where brahmacharya is like refraining from exploiting another being sexually. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't mean that you have to be chaste in this traditional way, but it's more just, how we go about, you know, and like, I think it was actually extended to... I remember what it was from. It was from a book on yoga and vegetarianism, and it was explaining about how brahmacharya should also extend to other species, so that's why we wouldn't have milk from a cow or like eggs from chickens, because we're actually exploiting their reproductive system. So that's why I always remember it.
Wow,
it was quite beautiful and rang very true. So,
thank you. Thank you. Yeah, so there's, so much there, right?
Mm.
You could talk about that a lot, but I wanted to specifically, one of the things when I think about action, I think about wise action in the world, I think of many of my friends who are more activistly inclined than I am. And so I've wondered if Angela will say something. You were at the climate march, yeah?
Yes.
How come?
It was Jane.
Yeah.
And Diana, who's not here tonight.
I was there too.
Oh, you were there too. See, there's quite a few of us. And I don't particularly regard myself as activists, but for me it comes down to that mix of the precept and wise action around doing, ensuring that we do no harm. So not just killing, although that's certainly the end of the scale, but for me climate change is providing immeasurable suffering in the world. And so my own right action in my own life has been to do certain things. Mm. And in terms of, taking to the streets, I think for me it's actually mixes in with right speech there, because it is right speech to call out what's happening in the world and what we can do about it.
Mm.
So that was a wonderful kind of example of wise action. And I, in pondering some of this, I was also pondering, what did the Buddha say or do about that stuff. And he does have his own examples, and the one that came to mind was once his movement got quite fulsome in terms of numbers of people, they had to... what was happening was the rice paddies were being destroyed by so many monks walking around with their alms bowls.
Hmm.
And the most difficult time was during the rains when,
mm-hmm.
you know, they actually needed for the cultivation to be happening. So didn't want people tramping all through the rice paddy. So that was kind of, I think, the precursor for the wise reflection and wise action and wise speech around, well, okay, we're having a rains retreat, people. So we that understanding of the interdependence of things, not just in ourselves, but in the wider world.
Thank you. And that quality of renunciation, sometimes being part of the wise action that we take is to not trample.
Right. That's right. And yes, to not.
Yeah. Thank you. And then the last in this sila bucket, the conduct and ethics bucket, is wise livelihood or sama avijja, which pertains to not making our money by means that would be harmful to other beings. And there's lists upon lists, but there's, you know, some pointers about what that would mean, not selling people or firearms or intoxicants. I think that this one, having honest dealings as part of your livelihood, I feel like this one is such a profound place of practice in our contemporary society. We're living in a capitalist world and money is God, hey? And so finding a way to live skillfully within that system, for some of us we may find ways to opt out of it entirely, but most of us won't. We're living within a particular economic system and finding ways of hopefully having wise livelihood within that. And so what a beautiful opportunity to let our relationship with work and productivity and money actually be an expression of our Dharma practice, rather than what some of us may experience sometimes, which is it's an expression of stress. And lack and not enough and have to get more. And wow, we could really transform that just by seeing that, this is part of my Dharma practice. So those are the qualities in the sila bucket: wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood. And if that wasn't enough to keep us busy, like for life, we could go on to the samadhi, the concentration factors, wise effort, samavayama, which is essentially it means abandoning unskillful qualities and actions and behaviors and cultivating skillful and beneficial qualities and actions and behaviors. And it could be both abandoning them maybe even before they happen, if we're able to bring our quality of practice to it and we can see that we're, you know, heading down the trouble train, perhaps we'd be able to abandon an unhelpful quality or action before it really takes root and gets expressed in the world. But other times we're going to be all the way there and gone before we have that moment and that clarity and that opportunity to step back and decide to switch tracks. But either way, it's good news. At whatever point we can abandon harmful behavior, that's a good point to do it. And then on the flip side, we might be cultivating the wholesome and cultivating the positive, much like we did here tonight, cultivating this quality of rejoicing in other people's good fortune. And that's creating and cultivating something that wasn't there yet. Maybe some of you happen to have walked in this evening thinking about that. But you know, for many of us, we walked in thinking about how wet did my shoes get getting down the driveway. And so we purposely are planting seeds and cultivating these wholesome qualities. And then once they're blossoming within us, continuing to encourage and engage those qualities. That's wise effort, wise mindfulness, or samasati. This is probably the poster child of contemporary Buddhism, right? It's mindfulness. It's getting honest about what's really going on, like right now. Not yesterday, and not what might happen in 2 weeks, but just bringing our attention and awareness to this moment. How does the body feel? What was that thought? Oh, it's that same pattern of thought I've had a lot of. What's happening now? What's the breath now? Just brings this precision and clarity that offers us so much freedom, right? And then wise concentration, sama samadhi. Andy might share something about his recent retreat experience there, but something I'd like to say about the concentration factors, for me, when I first started practicing, it was very much in the sort of setting where I would come to a drop-in group like this once a week and try to sit and meditate, and that was it. And I would hear things about how meditation was supposed to increase your concentration, and I just didn't get it. That was not my experience at all. And certainly I've found that for me, more contained settings like a retreat setting is a opportunity to develop more concentration. But a way I've come to really very much love concentration practices is in what's called karnika samadhi, or momentary concentration. It's a very it's a Burmese style of practice in which we bring together that quality of mindfulness with just whatever's going on in this moment. And for me, that made it feel so so relevant and so possible to actually cultivate this quality in my life, because it wasn't about sitting still for a long time and attaining some rarefied state. It was about, can I really be fully in the flow moment by moment by moment and be concentrated on that as my concentration practice. So karnika samadhi was a game changer for me in terms of opening up this path factor to feel like I could connect with it somewhere. But then there's also the opportunity to go on retreat, which is pretty yummy. And how is yours? You just got back how long ago?
Yeah, 3 weeks ago. I went on a slightly different than an insight retreat. I was doing some more body practices. But just talking about concentration, I think retreats for me offer a profound gift, and that is to see what's possible in the life, which is very hard to do for me in daily life. To see what's possible in this body, in this mind, when there is space to really settle into concentration.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the experiences that I've had on retreats have sustained my practice for decades.
Mm-hmm.
One experience
mm-hmm.
has sustained my practice for decades.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I see, you know, outside of also just being able to take in more of the teachings when you're set up as well, when you have concentration, you can really absorb the teachings in ways that you can't in daily life. And then, you know, also those experiences of practicing in a community, and we talked about the sealer aspects, being able to practice those in a really dedicated space and with people who are on the path, and then also to feel connected to other people, even though you may be practicing every day on your own, to know that 6 months ago I sat with a group of people who were that dedicated. So many reasons, but I would say as far as concentration goes, it provides sort of like direction in the practice.
Mm-hmm. yeah, like kind of makes it, takes away some of the obstacles in some ways to open up that possibility.
Yeah, and it gives you inspiration that can carry through daily life. Was it a silent retreat or did you have?
It was a silent retreat.
It was, well, this particular one was, yeah, it was silent. A lot of hours of practice. There was times to check in with the group. I think that's important in the retreat. Some of them don't do that, but need that connection with, still feeling that connection of community within a silent retreat is important too. But.
Thank you. So those are our samadhi factors: wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. And so then we've got our wisdom factors, panya, wisdom. And samaditi, our wise view. So sometimes that's offered as the, when it's taught more in the sequential style, wise view or wise understanding is often taught at the beginning. It's so foundational, how we're, what direction we're looking, how are we aiming ourselves. The classical teaching about that is that, you know, wise view is comprised of do we have some understanding or some orientation toward the Four Noble Truths, toward the teachings that explain the sequence of causes and conditions in our lives, dependent origination? Do we have some orientation toward seeing the truth of impermanence and where we get clingy and graspy around our identity? And, you know, do we understand those fundamental teachings of the Buddha? That is what informs wise view. I've found that for me, wise view has, there's a quality that I see in people sometimes and that I seek to emulate myself, that I associate very much with wise view, and it's this quality of having a fluid and flexible mind, like a mind that, an open mind, one that is not locked on to particular views or particular opinions or particular preferences, but can just be fluid and open and spacious, questioning. You know, for me, that's an exemplar of wise view when I meet those people. And you know, occasionally when I have those moments where I'm able to respond to a situation and have that sense of openness and that I didn't lock down on my opinion or preference about it right away, I can see those things and amplify them. Pema Chodron wrote that when we're standing at the crossroads, unsure which way to go, we abide in prajnaparamita, this, the wisdom of emptiness. So when we're standing in the crossroads of our life, which we are every single moment standing at a crossroads, and if we can leave room to not have already decided what we're going to do and where we're going to go, that's when we're resting in the wisdom of emptiness and fresh potential and fresh possibility. Now, it doesn't mean that we're not going to decide to go to the store and because we need food in the cabinet and that we're going to walk a particular direction to get there. But it just means, could we bring this freshness to each moment instead of a sense of it already being locked down in our minds and in our opinions about it? To me, that is wise view. And the practice and studying what the Buddha taught in the Dharma and with these other seven paths, that moves me a little bit closer to having that fluid and flexible mind. And then the last one, wise intention, samasankappa. So again, we come back to renunciation as being fundamental to our wise intention in the world. Remember that the second noble truth points us toward craving as being a place that we get into trouble, craving and clinging. And so then the answer to that, the converse of that, is to let go. And that's what renunciation is. So we practice it in different ways. You know, on retreat, maybe the renunciation means no speech, for example. Other times, it might mean something different in our lives. But renunciation, the renunciation of views and opinions, that's always a good one for me to remember. I should probably get that like tattooed, right? Renounce your views and opinions. The cultivation of harmlessness, the cultivation of goodwill, these are sort of the definitions that the Buddha gave. But I'm going to convince Lindy over there to say something about wise intention.
Wise intention. Yeah, thanks, Lulu. I was reflecting on this today, thinking, okay, intentionality, I think, is something that we can relate to whether we're following the Dharma or not, the power of intention and how much that sets our compass for what comes next and guides our speech and guides our actions. And it reminded me of being in my 20s and having a completely different worldview about what was important and completely different intentions. So I'm thinking of my sort of mid-20-year-old self, loved to go out dancing, and the whole purpose of life was really to enjoy yourself and try and get a really attractive partner. And this is before I'd gotten into the Dharma. So let's say going out clothes shopping, my intention would very much be to make myself look as attractive as possible. And there are some terrible selfies of me back there, you know, with certain hats on, pulling like sexy faces into the camera that kind of make me feel a little bit ashamed when I look back on them now. But totally caught up in that and how that intention of to make yourself attractive or to get a partner totally guides your speech and actions. Mm. Like those nights spent clubbing, all of the speech was mostly gossip about who was hot and who was not. And most of the activity was about dancing with people who looked attractive. Yeah. And then in my early 30s, I went through a phase of, I lived on a couple of retreat centres for a few years, and completely different. So think like long hair, think like secondhand clothes, charity shops. I went through a phase where my intention was to be as harmless as possible. So harmlessness being, you know, something that's a bit more in line with the Dharma. So I'd only buy clothes where I knew the manufacturing history, and I knew that there hadn't been any child labour that was dodgy. So it made finding the right kind of clothes a bit more difficult, but at the time that felt like something to commit to. So my intention was very much to cause as little harm as possible in the commercial capitalist choices I was making. And that guided my speech and guided my actions. And this is when I was practicing and learning a little bit about the Dharma. But still, you know, there was an aspiration to hold the view. There was still very much a clinging to that identity of being a hippie is a good thing and being a banker is a bad thing. Mm. And all bankers are bad. And so I would sometimes find myself getting caught up in, you know, judging other people, basically, and harmful speech around my opinions of the way that other people live their lives. And then I was kind of training to be a meditation teacher, and my meditation teacher said to me, you know, if you're going to look like a hippie, you're probably only going to be able to teach meditation to hippies. You know, you probably want to smarten yourself up. And in the next couple of years, I didn't live so much on retreat centres, and I lived more in cities, and I was working with a charity that took mindfulness into schools and working with other organisations that started to take mindfulness into big organisations. And I realised that before I would go in to meet people, that this was right, you know, his advice was right, because in order to be relatable in that organisation, I would have to meet their expectations with image so that their staff would see me as relatable rather than this outsider who wouldn't then be able to communicate so skillfully. And so the intention was, I remember this kind of weird phase of having this intention to follow this advice, of an intention to dress in a skillful way for the benefit of the other person. Mm-hmm. And going clothes shopping with that intention was so fun. There was like still a wish to kind of look nice, but with a lot less clinging to identity than I can remember from my hippie self or from my 20-year-old club dancing self. It was kind of like dress up, like, oh, that's nice, yeah, and maybe they'll like that in that big organisation. And so, yeah, I think that intention to sort of dress in a way that meets somebody else's expectations in order to do something really skillful and helpful in their organisation was a really great guide, and yeah, in some way affected the action of clothes buying, but I think also guides my speech as well in those settings a little bit.
Mm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Buddha probably just overlooked the bit about
dress.
Outfits. Yeah. Sorry, what were you going to say?
I want to see the photos.
Yeah. It was in the days before phones, it's not so easy to show. But I get that thing about how much intention is a part of karma as well, like cause and effect. Like, you know, the intention to look nice now is so different from the intention to look nice in my 20s. And that caused, you know, it was fun, but it also caused a lot of suffering. Am I attractive enough? Am I getting closer to getting a partner? Am I living a meaningful life because I don't have a partner at the moment? Whereas that element of suffering is not so much prevalent now. Yeah.
Mm. Thank you. So those are the 8 path factors in 3 big buckets. We made it through the Sila bucket of ethical conduct with wise speech, wise action, and wise livelihood. The concentration samadhi bucket with wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. And the wisdom or panya bucket with wise view, wise intention. All of these different ways to engage with our practice personally and in terms of how we go out into the world. All of these different opportunities to be integrated and whole people and practitioners, because if our only Dharma practice is the minutes that we put onto our cushion, it's maybe a little thin. You know, maybe there's something so much richer and fuller and wholer possible for us. And That's the invitation. That's the path to freedom that the Eightfold Path is, that the Fourth Noble Truth offers us. So thank you for bearing with me through all of them for tonight. Thank you for chiming in and helping. And we do have a few minutes open still, so I'm curious to hear what of these factors has been juicy for you, which has been challenging for you, which one do you feel curious to explore? Yeah, it's open now.